You are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation, a national nonprofit dedicated to stillbirth and infant loss research, education, and awareness. Our guest today is Dr. Jason Collins, founder of the Pregnancy Institute and author of Silent Risk: Issues About the Human Umbilical Cord. Dr. Collins is the nation's top expert on umbilical cord accidents. Of the approximately 26,000 stillbirths each year in the United States, an estimated 8,000 are caused by umbilical cord accidents. Dr. Collins, a retired OB, has spent more than 25 years studying the role played by umbilical cords in stillbirths, and he believes it's possible to cut the number of stillbirths in half through increased monitoring. Follow Dr. Collins on Twitter at jcollinsmd77. Well, Dr. Collins, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Well, thank you for inviting me.
Let's start off very basic here. Why don't you explain the work of the Pregnancy Institute and what it stands for?
Well, Pregnancy Institute was created in 1996 to define normal pregnancy, and by doing that, begin to understand abnormal pregnancy. And one of the areas we focused on as abnormal pregnancy were babies that were stillborn, and one of the subcategories were babies that were stillborn with apparent umbilical cord pathology. And that came about because of a patient observation who lost a baby.
So that happened in 1991. Can you tell us a little bit more about that incident where you had a patient lose a baby and that essentially led to your passion and you spending the rest of your career devoted to this topic of stillbirth?
This patient, we'll call her D, went fishing in Lake Pontchartrain on Sunday. And early Monday morning, about 7 o'clock, she called me to say that she couldn't feel her baby moving. So I told her to come to the office, I'd meet her there, and we would, you know, look at it and see what we could find. So by the time we got to the point of looking with ultrasound, we did not see a heartbeat. So we went and induced the baby. And when it was born, it was quite unusual. The baby had two cords around the neck, cord around the chest, cord around the arm. And as it turned out, had a straight cord, a two-vessel cord, a 100-meter cord. And it was obvious it was a very unusual event, not like anything I had observed before. So, you know, on the website, you can look at that case history and see the picture of that baby. And it was just to the point where it just stimulated my curiosity to the point of how did this baby do this and why were there no prenatal symptoms that we were aware of? Unless they were, we just didn't notice it.
You have said in the past that you believe that these simple cord compressions, they account for a large portion of stillbirths, and that many in the medical community call them flukes or unpreventable. You seem to believe the contrary to that. Can you talk about why you believe that many of these umbilical cord accidents and these stillbirths are preventable?
Well, number one, I think that it's underestimated, and world literature makes it clear that stillborns that have received study, autopsy, laboratory, etc., run between 15 and 20% of all stillbirths. So it's not uncommon. It's more common than babies that are stillborn with moms that have diabetes or high blood pressure, which is around 8 to 10%. So it is a common event, and it is demonstrated and proven based on autopsy, cord compression, which leaves placental changes, was the cause. Now, when you look at the whole picture, a lot of babies that probably are lost to cord compression, when they're born, the cord compression site is erased, so you don't see it. So, for example, if you have a loop around the ankle and you pull the baby out, well, the loop gets pulled off, so you don't know it played a role. There may also be cord positions like alongside the head, which we call occult prolapse, that are never seen. And actually, there's one paper where they looked at stillborn babies with ultrasound and concluded that there were, quote, a lot of abnormal cord positions related to these stillborns. So that's why I believe there's more to it than people have realized.
So we know that umbilical cord abnormalities are found in approximately 30% of successful pregnancies. How does this factor into the challenges of your work?
Well, what people need to understand that want to understand this issue is that the cord issues that cause death are the perfect storm. So when you evaluate these cases, you just can't talk about, oh, well, the cord was looped around the neck, which some resident may notice, put down on a progress note. They do the study. They got 300 pages. Oh, yeah, I see. We didn't see anything. No, that's not how it works. You got to put the perfect storm back together. You got to look at where the placenta was, where the cord was inserted, what type of cord there was. There's 8 different forms. Nobody ever documents the type of form they're dealing with. And then you've got the type of AV nuchal cord, and you've got to document that. And then where was the baby relative to all this? So if you just say, oh, well, the baby had a cord around the neck, oh, we see that all the time. No, it's not the same thing. You're only looking at one dimension of a multidimensional problem.
Is there any way for expecting parents to know if an umbilical cord issue is going to be a problem? In other words, if they get an ultrasound and it looks like the umbilical cord is in a rough spot or a spot that causes an alarm, what would you tell parents in that situation?
Well, the first thing they need to be taught is how is the baby behaving. So the mother has to be the radar. She has to be the one that understands the personality of the baby. And the baby establishes their personality between 24 and 26 weeks. By then, they have a regular circadian rhythm of behavior that is most obvious at bedtime. There are reasons for this. And so when the mom gets ready to go to bed or lays down, her baby should have a particular behavior that ought to be just about very consistent night to night till the end of pregnancy. Babies never slow down, and they usually aren't hyperactive. If they are, which is the two extremes of behavior, you want to get checked.
Let's talk about imaging and technology. Where are we at today, and what is the standard practice of being able to capture images of the umbilical cord in the womb?
Where we are today is that umbilical cord form, pathology, orientation can all be seen crystal clear with 3D 4D ultrasound. It can be verified with color Doppler ultrasound, and it can certainly be seen with fetal MRI, which is rather new, but that is as clear as the bell about what you're dealing with. So you have to know those characteristics. Where is the cord attached to placenta? What does the cord look like morphology-wise? And where is it relative to the baby? Those are three fundamental elements which we call defined pregnancy. And until you do that, then you're not going to find this problem, fix this problem, manage this problem. You got to know those three elements.
And I notice you keep saying, you got to know these things, as if you're talking about the patient. Is that to say that this technology is not being utilized to its fullest extent in hospitals?
No, it's not. And the mother has to insist upon it, because there is an ideology out there that these are not important issues. There's a lot of excuses given about it. But the simple of it is, if you can diagnose the sex of a baby on a 20-week ultrasound, then you can diagnose the cord issues on a 20-week ultrasound.
You're asking mothers and fathers to be their own best advocates. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes.
Empower the patient.
Yes.
I know you've kind of touched on this, but let's just go with Collins's tips for mothers. What should pregnant mothers watch for during their pregnancy when it comes to some of the concerns that you have and the things that you focus on in your practice?
The most important idea to convey to the moms is learn your baby's behavior. Learn what your baby does over a 24-hour period. Learn how your baby reacts to you when you're walking in the mall, going to the grocery store, laying down to go to bed. That's the most ideal factor to say something has changed. Once you detect the change, then you want to know what the degree of change is, and then you want to pursue an evaluation if you think it's way above what you're used to.
You know, I think a lot of mothers and fathers who might be listening to this right now may be wondering if they are at risk for an umbilical cord accident or an umbilical cord issue. So are they genetic? are certain people more at risk than others? If you've had one in the past, are you more likely to have it again?
Yeah, there are risk factors. There are genetic factors. One of the genetic factors that might be involved is people are tending to make long cords. Long cords are over 75 centimeters. I think the longest one was 300 centimeters. So if you make a long cord, that is a risk factor. If you're making a lot of amniotic fluid, polyhydramnios, that is a risk factor. If you've had losses, that is a risk factor. So there are things to take into account that if you've had this experience, you definitely want to be a little more alert as to this possibility.
So anyone who has read or is familiar with your materials, you talk a lot about hiccups in babies. Can you tell us more about the relationship to hiccups and risk?
There are two types of hiccups. You have a physiological hiccup, which is part of the development of the phrenic nerve, which innervates the diaphragms. So that matures around 24 weeks and helps the baby exercise his breathing muscles, just like a bird exercising their wings in a nest. So as that nervous system matures through the vagus system, these babies tend to have hiccups. Now, on the average, and people have studied this, they've studied it with ultrasound over 24 hours, they've studied it in a variety of ways, these babies tend to have hiccups 5 to 10 minutes long several times a day. The standard is at least 3 to 4 episodes in a 24-hour period. So if you're experiencing hiccups after 26, 28 weeks, where the nerve has matured and everything's settling down, and you're having 10 to 15-minute hiccup episodes, and you're having them 3 and 4 times a day over 12 hours where you notice it, because you're not going to notice it while you're sleeping, then you have an issue, and the most likely issue is the cord is being compressed more than 30% and triggering this reflex. It's a reflex just like you blink in your eye for dust in your eye. The baby has this reflex to get itself off of a compression point, and that's what pathologic hiccups are. And if you have that, you want to be evaluated with ultrasound.
So a woman who's pregnant, whose baby is experiencing hiccups, what would your recommendation be?
If she's in the pattern we described, if she's having hiccups after, let's say, 26 weeks, and they're taking place for 10 to 15 minutes long, and they're happening during the day several times where she notices it, she needs to go and ask for an ultrasound and ask to look at the cord. It can be between the legs, it can be under the arm, the baby can be sucking on it, causing triggering this reflex, but you want to find out where the cord is, where the reflex is being triggered.
You talk a lot about the difference between fetal activity during the day and at night. Can you describe the relationship between umbilical cord issues and maternal sleep while the mom is sleeping?
Well, when the mom is sleeping, her vital signs, her heart rate, her pulse, her breathing, her blood pressure, all this is slowly ratcheting down during what we call REM sleep. There are very few studies of how the baby adjusts to the mom between midnight and 6 a.m. during REM sleep. So he has to adjust. He has to adjust to those different parameters. And what he'll do if he gets what I call stuffy is he'll start maneuvering, kicking the mother, and that's when the mother will get up and go to the bathroom real quick and go back to sleep. And this event usually takes place at least once a night, as many as twice a night, in 3 to 4 hour intervals. That's normal. That's expected. But if you're doing this several times a night, well, then this baby is waking you up for a reason because it's not getting the blood flow it wants. And again, that's a fetal reflex doing that.
When you were a practicing OB, how did you yourself manage concerns for umbilical cord problems?
Well, it took us a while, but eventually we developed this idea called define the pregnancy. So by 20 weeks, we want to know where the placenta is. We want to know dimensions of the placenta, its length, its width, and its thickness. Then we want to know where the cord is. We want to know if it's centrally located, marginally located on the edge, or if it's a vasa previa, where it's, not attached to placenta, it's just free in the membranes. Once we know that, then we want to know where the baby is, and we want to make sure the cord attachment to the baby is normal, because it can be narrowed, called constriction. We want to know that too. And then over time, as we visit with the mom and the baby, we want to know that the heartbeat is stable by doing a non-stress test every visit, every 3 weeks. And we want to know that the behavior is within a normal parameter, what we talked about. If we see aberration, if we see D-cells on the non-stress test, if the mother's telling us, my baby's moving all over the place at night, which they will say, well, then we know there's something going on, and now we're going to go to ultrasound, and we're going to try to figure out what's going on, and if, in fact, there may be entanglement causing these behaviors to happen.
So I know that the advice that you have given mothers and fathers has led to babies' lives being saved many, many times over throughout your career. Is there a certain story or a certain memory that sticks out to you as the most impactful or most memorable?
Last summer was I got a call from an MD from Los Angeles that had a wife with a history of infertility, and he called me because he was concerned about losing the baby. And after speaking to him and realizing he didn't have a lot of evaluation, just fundal height, heart rate with a stethoscope, et cetera, I suggested he go to the labor and delivery unit and be evaluated. When he did, he got a non-stress test, sent me a picture of it on his iPhone, and the baby was having D-cells. So when he got home, he called me back, and I said, you really want to go back? That did not look good to me, and I'm surprised they let you go. So he ended up going back. They ended up keeping him, and he developed more D-cells, and they did an emergency C-section the next morning, and the baby had three cords around the neck, which was part of the problem. So he was very grateful, and he sent me a picture of the baby from the labor and delivery room, but that baby may not have survived had that father not been proactive, concerned about losing a very precious pregnancy, and I was able to help him by giving him the information that he was able to use. So that was a very fulfilling story, that he was able to do that.
So it's very clear from talking to you that your mission in what you are doing here at the Pregnancy Institute has a ton of challenges. You're faced with challenges every day. And as you know, this podcast that we're doing is presented by the Star Legacy Foundation, and its number one goal is to prevent stillbirth in the United States. In your opinion, what is the top obstacle, or maybe the top couple of obstacles, in preventing stillbirths in this country?
Well, number one, stillbirth can be prevented. That is a definite. In order to prevent stillbirth, you got to go look for the baby at risk. In order to find the baby at risk, you got to define the pregnancy, which means you got to use the modern tools of ultrasound and fetal monitoring to evaluate each baby that's suggesting that it's not behaving normally. And it can be done, and it's just a matter of informing the mom rather than convincing the professional bodies who really don't feel comfortable doing that evaluation for any number of reasons. So it's going to take the mom to insist on those evaluations so they can be sure that their babies are clearly evaluated and that their risk of running into a surprise event is diminished, and the most likely surprise event to run into is cord pathology, because nobody's looking for it.
Without opening an entire can of worms, I think a lot of mothers and fathers would listen to that advice and say, why is it my obligation to look for these things when the experts are in the hospitals and we're paying a lot of money for these services, for these experts who went to school for many years to take care of us and do what's best for us? Can you talk a little bit about why you have resulted, after all these years, in just saying we need the moms and the dads to do the advocacy work on their behalf, and instead of going to the professionals at the hospitals and making them make a systemic change?
Sometimes in science, you have issues like this where there's a lot of disagreement. So when you run into that moment in science, you have to do it yourself. And it's important to make sure that while the professionals are still debating the issue and not sure how they want to approach it, for instance, people that you talk to in various countries about recognizing abnormal cord insertion into placenta will say, oh, well, you know, on the organizational professional level, they don't think it's cost effective. Personally, I don't think a cost-effective argument versus keeping a baby from dying is legitimate, ethical, or moral. You have the tools work, use the tools, find the baby, and so what if it's one per thousand? Nobody cares about cost effectiveness when it comes down to the life of a baby if you believe that. Now, there's some people that just don't believe that, and that's the difference. So the only way that you can get it done is the patient has to do it themselves until you reach a point in time culturally where people begin to accept that idea and want to make it a priority that no baby is lost for any type of reason, especially cord pathology, which can be imaged, which can be managed, which can be successfully delivered.
So when you took on this issue of stillbirth and umbilical cord accidents, you were taking a career risk. You're not the most popular person amongst many of your peers, and you've taken a risk, and your career changed the day that you decided that you wanted to dedicate your life's work to helping people who have experienced stillbirth and helping people prevent stillbirth. My question is, why? Why have you decided to devote your career to this topic?
Well, because by nature, I'm a curious person. And by nature, I'm probably more of an engineer than an OB. And what that means is I like to solve problems. And I saw a very unusual problem that nobody was talking about, wasn't really in the textbooks, and said, well, heck, we ought to be able to fix this. And it took a while to figure it out, but we figured it out. And the best example I could give you is Semmelweis, who was the European OB that discovered beta strep causing puerperal fever. He figured out that the people that did not wash their hands in the hospital and examined pregnant women and went from pregnant woman to pregnant woman were spreading beta strep. So, you know, he started washing his hands with carbolic acid, which was coming about at the time, the discovery of organisms. And he was absolutely demeaned for it and called a fraud for it and eventually went crazy. The other person is Pasteur, who was able to cure rabies. And he was diminished by the French Scientific Society for what he was advocating, which is basically, vaccines for rabies, smallpox, and other things. So these events take place in science and medicine. Those are two stories of many stories, when people just aren't ready to accept the solution and believe it's true.
Well, Dr. Collins, on behalf of the Star Legacy Foundation and really anyone who has been impacted by pregnancy loss, thank you for being the crazy one and for standing up for what we believe in. And thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. And I have fully enjoyed and am still enjoying figuring out this problem and seeing how consistent I can get in solving it. And we're at a pretty good level of being pretty consistent about it. So I find it just fascinating, to tell you the truth.
Thank you for listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Visit us online at starlegacyfoundation.org.